This episode is brought to you in part by the generosity of Patreon supporters. You too can become a Blotter Presents tipster at patreon.com/blotterpresents. And now, the episode. He said, "I know my rights, don't bother." I said, "I want to advise you. Everybody has to be advised of his rights." He said, "What can I tell you? If you got witnesses, I'm fucked." I said, "We got witnesses." He said, "Well, then I'm fucked." Return with us now to those thrilling days of yesteryear, when skyjackers terrorized air travelers on a regular basis, but with a remarkable dearth of casualties, when a Westies-adjacent hooligan could commit a double homicide and walk into another life, and when people read books! A nonfiction page-turner that made a bunch of 2013's best-of lists, The Skies Belong to Us, and a New Yorker crime joint from 2000 that made me long to reread Calvin Trillin's Killings, it's The Blotter Presents, episode 81. Welcome back to The Blotter Presents, a podcast reviewing true crime. True crime, not crime. Thumbs down on crime. Thumbs up on my guest, first-time Blotter Presents co-counsel Alex Segura. Welcome, Alex.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Thanks so much for coming on the show. I am very excited to actually be reading a true crime book at the same time as anyone else. I feel like we as a reading nation have splintered somewhat. But in today's first cold case section, we'll be talking about a book that actually was recommended to me by Toby Ball, which is how we've actually never met in person, but which is how we met, was on the Toby Ball's Deep Dive supplementary podcast. Yes, it's called The Skies Belong to Us, and here is the case file. In early June 1972, Roger Holder and Kathy Kirkow hijacked a Western Airlines flight using a fake bomb as leverage and conveyed themselves to Algiers. The craziest skyjacking you've probably never heard of, perhaps because it got lost in an improbable shuffle of near weekly skyjackings during the Nixon presidency. Brendan Koerner's The Skies Belong to Us intersperses Holder and Kirkow's love story and its shabby aftermath, with the myriad skyjackings taking place at the time. How myriad, you ask? D.B. Cooper is dispensed with in two economical but extremely informative paragraphs, and the birth of modern airline security. Well, modern until September 12, 2001. So I would like to start, if we may, with the New York Times blurb on the front cover of the paperback edition from one Dwight Garner. Quote, "A pure pop masterpiece. Reading this is like watching a Scorsese movie or hearing the best song of summer squirt out of the radio."
Wow.
Squirt. Dwight, you want to talk to me like that? You really need to buy me dinner first.
Yeah, exactly. That seems a little too graphic.
Yeah. Just.
I don't know if that's how I'd take, that's not how I would react to the book. I mean, it was excellent, but it didn't strike me as like a big budget film, you know?
Well, the thing is, though, the quote works. I mean, he's correct. It's one of the most purely readable books that I've had the in a single day pleasure of ripping through in recent memory. But sometimes the writing of the book does parallel the writing of that blurb. Sometimes it's very efficient and evocative, and other times you have the description of Kathy greeting Roger at the door and like shower water sluicing between her breasts, and you're like, dude, what is going on? So yes, your general impression of the book is that it was excellent overall. Did the writing work for you, or did you have the same issues that I had occasionally?
You know, there were little hiccups. I think there were some lags, but that's going to happen, especially when it's nonfiction. It's not tightened together by, you know, a fictionalized plot. So there were moments where I was like, okay, I'd like to move past this whole Algiers sequence. And but then something interesting would happen, and you're pulled into like the Black Panther movement, and then they move to Paris. And I thought what was interesting is that it just felt like, and I think you had the same experience in just reading it so quickly, it was just such a fast-paced, well-structured book that, you know, I got lost in it in a way that doesn't happen that often with true crime. Like sometimes there are just sections that you have to slog through, like especially with the more generic stuff, but this felt really well structured. And I thought he fleshed out the characters in a nice way and contextualized it for the time. And I had no idea this had happened. And I've read a lot of books set in that period and read a lot of stuff about Nixon and his presidency. And it's almost like this lost chapter in American history, because I feel like we solved the problem, you know, ha ha ha. But
well, yeah.
Yeah, we didn't. And, I didn't mean that to make light of it, but it just felt like something that we'd kind of hid under the rug, even though it was rampant for so long.
Yeah. My husband is a bit older than me and remembers this being a thing, like on the nightly news nightly sometimes, or
wow,
like several nights in a row, and Johnny Carson joking about it and that kind of thing.
It's like, why would anyone fly? I would never get on a plane.
Yeah. But you know, then there are like moments in the book where, like he talks mostly about this hijacking, but he gets sort of tangentially into many, many others. And there's some section where whatever kidnapped passengers and crew have wound up in, you know, usually it was Havana at that time, but wherever their destination was, and when they're waiting to be debriefed, and then returned to the States, they're given like a chicken dinner, and this is like acceptable, that they're like, well, you know, sorry for the delay, folks, meals on us in like the Turkish embassy or wherever they are, just waiting for another plane to come pick them up from the hijacking. But there really was like a, as I mentioned before, a relatively low loss of life compared with, you know, those of us who remember 9/11 and have been living in the post 9/11 world. You kind of hear the word skyjacking and you expect that there will be no survivors anywhere.
And he touches on that a little bit in the end, how the kind of way we deal with the term has changed, you know, not just due to 9/11, but how, you know, the security changes made it much harder to get there, and people started using the planes themselves as weapons, which is terrifying. But I think early on in the book, I was so blown away by just how much comfort you had on a flight, you know, like dinner, drinks, leg room, like all these things that you have to pay like hundreds of dollars extra.
I was in first class recently and was startled to be served coffee in a mug. And was like,
was
country come to town about it too. Oh yes, it was beautiful, hot, strong Starbucks in a China mug. And I was like, ooh, this is so exciting. Yeah.
Yeah, I think we had dinner on a flight once, and that's because we were just flying internationally. That seems to be the only time you get a meal.
Yeah. I mean, look, we all saw Airplane. So sometimes you're better off. But yeah, Koerner does talk about how hijacking demands mutated, I guess, or evolved, I guess whichever term you think sounds more stern and discouraging. Yeah, let's go with mutated.
Yeah.
And that's sort of when he deals with D.B. Cooper, who I guess we'll get to later. But I was impressed with the prose, particularly in the sections where he is focused on the larger context of these skyjackings, their frequency, etc., that he really kept it moving. And there are many times, just in like general history nonfiction, where you definitely get the sense that the author, and I am absolutely sympathetic to this, the author did this research, and God damn it, It's going to be in there. Like, I read a book on Leopold and Loeb that really, mm-hmm. I think in an effort to make it less salacious seeming vis-a-vis them and their crime, which, like, you know, it was horrible, and that's like the nature of the crime itself is why we're still captivated by it in part. Yeah. But there were like whole chapters about the prosecutor, and you're just like, no one's here for that. I regret to inform you that if you this is filed in true crime, more pictures, less history.
But yeah, you're right. He did. I thought, you know, I call it zooming out and zooming in, just because he was able to follow these two characters and use them as your entry point. And I think he was very smart about that, because I feel like other authors would have jumped around and maybe given you snippets of different skyjackings. But he used this as the through line. But then he was able to zoom out and give you this context, like this is how prevalent it was at the time. So you get these little bursts of research or information, but it never felt like, oh God, he's just copying and pasting from his like info dump document into the book. It felt really like it flowed really well. I mean, there were always like a few bumps in the road, but overall I think it was really smart of him to do that, to use this one specific skyjacking, probably because it was most interesting to him, but I think it was like the biggest heist, I guess, at the time.
Well, and then it ends up having the most, I think, well, not only sort of the most to say about certain other issues that were not really that tangential actually to this particular mm-hmm. crime, but and I'll talk about that in a sec, but I think he did an excellent clever job of alternating between these two specifically and the zoom out, like you just said.
Yeah.
And that each of them set the other off well, because if it had just been a straight, like, let's do a zippy, it felt almost like, not cinematic, I don't know how to put it exactly, but it did feel like you were watching an extremely effective Smithsonian Channel montage at times, because his way of setting up or arranging the facts was so compelling. But I think it was
like a really tightly edited documentary with reenactment of some kind, I guess.
Yeah.
But good reenactment, not like a cheesy
exactly.
Silent reenactment.
You know, in slow-mo with a bullet slowly spinning on the ground. He gets a ton of information in. Sometimes there are certain skyjackings that I'm like, I want to hear more about that. But he's so smart to just mm-hmm. touch on things. And his use of detail is, he has a good touch with that too. Like this list, there's a list on page 216 of the paperback of finally the airlines realize that they need to start implementing better security and stop whining about how it's going to cost them money. So they're searching, they implement searches, but like if they find weapons, they quote just have to, like, the passengers just have to put them in their checked luggage.
Yeah.
So he talks about how it still wasn't clear whether if they found drugs in your bag that was like admissible in court. So quote, guards were instructed to search only for weapons. They discovered an abundance: handguns, knives, swords, batons, screwdrivers, fish saws, even a black widow spider stored in a mason jar. And apparently the spider was like put in checked luggage and got to its destination fine.
Okay,
like the spider reappears a couple of paragraphs later. They're like, don't worry.
It survived.
Like, cool.
It was great to hear that. I mean, not great, but it was oddly soothing in these turbulent times to realize that our country has always been kind of whacked out in terms of stuff like this, like just slow moving and just the, you know, like the airline governing body not wanting to do this because it would be so expensive. You know, like the gears always move so slowly, you know, and we somehow think that just now, because everything is in disarray. It's the worst of the worst, but it's always been kind of effed up.
Yeah,
I guess.
Yeah, that's true.
Which was strangely, I was like, okay, so it's not always, it's always been kind of crappy, I guess.
Well, and the sort of lobbies have always had this outsized influence. Like, I think living in 2019 America, where, like, you know, the sort of nefarious influences of business and lobbies on the government are the worst they've ever been, which is possible, but they've always been horrible, like, for hundreds of years, literally.
Yeah, like, since the beginning, basically.
Yeah. And he has this one line about how the, I think it was the American, I think it was AAA, was like, oh, yeah, totally. Up security. We'll pay for the x-ray machines, figuring that people would think this was a big, scary pain in the ass and would drive more.
Right. Right.
Only to get screwed like 2 years later by, you know, gas lines and stagflation and whatnot.
Yeah.
Were there any specific, like segments of the story that you wish he had, zoomed in further on or for longer?
Well, I think towards the end, when they're in Paris and Holder's kind of melting down, he obviously had spoken to Holder, and so he had a lot more of his story. And Kirkow had, I mean, I don't know how much we can, I guess, spoil the whole thing. Like, she disappears or she goes off the grid, and it's, it just makes it more challenging because then he can only speculate about what she did. Whereas Holder, you get a much clearer picture of Holder. At this time. So it kind of felt like you feel the imbalance there towards the end. And that's kind of when you realize that the book is winding down. But I thought he tied that up really nicely by kind of inserting himself into that last fifth of the book where he, you know, we follow him to talk to Holder, which I thought explained away any discrepancy. But I was kind of baffled by why they stayed together so long, but and I think it would have helped to know a little more about what they liked about each other beyond like the physical attraction and the we're in this together idea of it.
Yeah, I sort of struggled a little bit with his, not his portrayal of Kirkow, but I feel like he might have imputed more depth to her and more I don't know. Like, she just seemed, based on what we knew of her up to the and sort of through the hijacking,
right?
She just seemed like kind of an aimless adolescent.
But then she becomes this like femme fatale,
right? Which I sort of was like, you know, because she successfully got European men to buy
for dinner
for her. Yeah. Which, like, yeah. Look, if this is how you're going to survive and not go back to the States, I also wish there had been a slightly, like, that my hand had been held a little longer about why they could just be in out in the world. Like, it just seemed like, you know, they land in a place, everyone sort of files off the plane. And then that's it. I mean,
they're there.
Yeah, it was explained in the sections where they're talking about the earlier skyjackers who invariably were asking to go to Cuba. That was explained a little better, and certainly those folks were not like, you know, living it up on the beach.
I found that really interesting. I mean, my parents are Cuban, so I was really like into that aspect of it, just learning about how Castro, you know, basically sent these hijackers to penal, like, you know, they were in jail in like very severe prisons. And then the whole idea that because he was annoyed that these people were coming here, he made the first treaty, like he finally negotiated some extradition treaty with the U.S., which they had no existing like diplomatic relations up until that point. So it was like even that was in like a secondary lost chapter to our history. But yeah, I agree. Like, they just kind of show up and then you just accept that they're there. But I would have liked a little more of that explanation.
I also, I respect that he was like, here's what I think happened to Kathy Kirkow. And here's, you know, in my mind's eye, this is what happened to her and this is what she's doing. I thought he dwelt perhaps a little too long on the idea that she had died, as though that were an obvious option. Like, maybe by now she has, but as of when she vanished off the grid, she was what, 30? So that didn't seem real likely to me. But did you want him to like go down that rabbit hole, or did you think it was a good idea for him to be like, here's what I think happened and this is a whole other book, so I'm out?
You know, now that I think about it, now that you bring it up, when I was reading it, I was like, okay, the book is ending, so I'll kind of humor this detour into fantasy. But in retrospect, I don't think it works. I'd rather he just said she disappeared at this point and she was not found. You know, she hasn't been found, or, you know, and then just kind of give us the facts, because everything before that point was so fact-based and so well-researched. And he showed that he could take this research and really make it into this tightly paced, engaging story, that the gear shift to just pure speculation just caught me a little off guard, but it wasn't bad. I mean, I read it and I remember thinking, okay, that makes sense. So it didn't make me toss the book across the room, but
no,
I think it could have been stronger without it.
Yeah. And I felt like this was not something that he wanted to do. This was like not the kind of crime book he wanted to write. And again, that's fine. Listeners, if you know that there's like a subreddit about like hashtag where is Kirkow, or anything else, that any other investigation that has been done on this, like the property that we're going to talk about in our second section, there's a sequence in which they're trying to find a guy, and they find a guy with the same first name and a birthday 1 year, 1 month, and 1 day off from their target. And like, they track this guy down, and this was in like the late 90s, before the internet was necessarily a thing. And I just feel like, well, like, how much work on this did you do?
Right. Seems a little rushed.
Yeah. Because I mean, I don't need her to like come back to the States and face justice. Like, not really, but
right.
Like, where is she? Like, that's going to bug me now.
Yeah, now I'm tempted to go do my own research. But I mean, it was such a little smudge on a really great book. So I was willing to forgive it, and it wasn't that big a deal. Like, grading on a curve, it was still high marks across the board. But that did, I just felt like, why? Why are we in this kind of theoretical land when everything else has been so grounded? And you mentioned editorial notes, and part of me wondered while reading it, was this something that the publisher asked him to do? Like, we have to kind of tie things up for her, even though there are no facts to do that. That's pure speculation on my part, but it did cross my mind.
Right. Well, it does seem, given the way the Golden State Killer was caught, as though, like, just, I don't know, send some hair to 23andMe from like her aunt or something. And like, she might pop somewhere. You never know. Or don't, not to be invasive. I'm not telling anyone to do this, but It is interesting. He actually has a website for the book with some auxiliary materials and stuff like that, that I'll link to in the show notes. I didn't really dig into the whole site, but maybe there have been updates. Maybe there's like a Where is Kathy section. I doubt it, but that is one thing that I was like, like, is this something where they tried to do this part of it and the editor was like, this isn't working, just speculate and then cut the rest of it. So, all right, before we wrap this up, I have to ask you, I don't know how exactly this became a thing, in my sort of public persona. I am known for a few things, hating raisins, screaming the word space during Extra Hot Great Game Time because I don't watch any sci-fi and I always get the trivia questions wrong, and enjoying chickens, and also being obsessed with DB Cooper. I'm not actually that obsessed with DB Cooper. I kind of have made my peace with the case, and it's
session.
Like if the FBI gave up, Buncey is also giving up. Right. How much do you care about D.B. Cooper? And pursuant to that, how did you feel about the fact that the most famous skyjacker of them all was contained in like two paragraphs?
I am not obsessed with D.B. Cooper. Okay. If there was a D.B. Cooper spectrum, I would be at the opposite end of where you are. Not by any dislike of D.B. personally. It was fine. I was fine with it. I felt like I really liked the fact that he went with these characters or people because he found them the most interesting, and he used D.B. Cooper as kind of context, but I wasn't like offended by it. But now I feel like you're going to like me less because
care about D.B. Cooper. Look, I am actually not like anytime there's any news item on D.B. Cooper, someone pings me on Twitter, and I'm not telling people not to do that. I'm telling people not to expect a lightning fast response. My husband recently reobsessed me with it. I was like talking to him about reading this book the other night, and he came up with the theory that D.B. Cooper like didn't exist or was like a member of the flight crew in drag, and then they all split the ransom. And that's why they never found a body, is because they threw a like Recessa Annie out the back.
Oh, wow.
I was like, you are a crackpot. I like it.
Yeah. Yeah, I'd watch that.
Yeah, for sure. I thought this was absolutely the smartest play in a book that is not about D.B. Cooper. And I did not know this information about experienced skydivers, quote, scoffing at the notion that Cooper could have survived his jump. And then he just very briefly goes into the reasons for that, and that he didn't ask for a backup, and he didn't have any safety equipment and all this stuff, and relaying that to my husband Dan, no relation to Dan Cooper. He was like, I wonder if they just chucked a dummy out and then hoped they'd find most of the ransom money later. And I was like, that's ridiculous.
It just gets the wheels turning.
Yeah, but this was absolutely Kerner's smartest play, that it's like, all right, I'm not writing about D.B. Cooper, I have to mention the guy. But he's like, this is me bringing him up in the timeline. This is me telling you that he didn't live. Next. And I was like,
yeah, I thought it was.
That must have been, you know, you turn in your manuscript and you're like, two paragraphs. What am I doing?
Fingers crossed that they are fine with that minimalist approach.
Yeah, he got away with it, though. And I think that there are many times that, well, you can't necessarily point to a negative, but there are places where he could say much more about a number of ancillary issues, like that Holder was just like turned inside out by his war experiences, by racism in the country, in the army, that Kirkow could vanish with her like suspiciously perfect French,
right,
into another,
which was mentioned a few times, like he was really emphasizing that she spoke really good French.
And but then he didn't follow that particularly was frustrating to me about like a dearth of follow-up on her story,
right.
Was like, well, but you kept pointing out that she was just sort of a like to smoke Sinsemilla and was a lackadaisical student, so where'd the perfect French come from?
Yeah, that was interesting.
So there's her ability to sort of pass as whatever she passed as and, you know, become someone else in Europe, and then Holder's inability to do that. So I thought that he successfully raised these things but didn't underline them or stop the narrative to be like, here's me, you know, railing at the VA. Like, he just let the story speak for itself. And
yeah,
it's not easy. And again, I'm absolutely sympathetic to I complain about this frequently on Goodreads. Mm-hmm. I'm like, you know, just because you did all this research, like, just put it in a footnote. We'll find you after class.
Yeah. Yeah. If we're really into it, we'll dive into the footnotes.
Yeah.
So this one thing about this book is, I'm sorry.
No, go ahead.
One thing about this book that's, it was actually recommended to me years ago, and I've had it on my to read pile forever. And before you and I even talked about it, I started reading it. So when you sent me that list, I was like, oh, well, I'm reading this. And it just seemed, it kept getting bumped down and down for some reason. And I don't know why. Maybe because skyjacking just seemed like this very bizarre, unrealistic, kind of fantastical thing. And then you read the book and it was so prevalent. It was just kind of mind blowing.
Well, and the subtitle is Love and Terror in the Golden Age of Hijacking. And you're like, the Golden Age of Hijacking? What were there, like,
yeah,
three?
So
like, no, there were three, like, on my birthday in 1973. Forget
wow.
Three total. So, actually, there weren't, but, you know, figuratively, there could have been.
At least one, yeah.
Yeah. Odds were. And it's funny that you mentioned reading a lot about Nixon and his presidency and that not coming up, because it really doesn't. Like, I've read just about every Nixon bio. I read all the Woodward and Bernstein books.
Right.
Nada.
It's just not mentioned at all.
Yeah.
It's all about Watergate. It's all about the Vietnam War. It's all about his, reclaiming himself after losing to Kennedy. And it's not, there's, I can't remember one skyjacking being mentioned.
No, me neither. Yeah, I really, that's a strange thing. There's a, these books tend to flow through like the family of origin and then be left in vacation houses. So there was one, I don't remember the name of it, but I think it's the best one I read. And it's basically the psychology of Nixon and looking at all the major events of his adult life and presidency through that lens. It's extremely well written and it doesn't sort of hammer its thesis too hard. And I would love to go back and look at it and see if that's mentioned in there, but it was left somewhere in Massachusetts.
Yeah, I wonder if I didn't have my, you know, antenna up for that, or, you know, just kind of skim through it since it's not the thrust of the book, but I can't remember it coming up.
No. And I mean, if it really was happening, like my husband says that he was Nixon, and the book mentions at least two addresses that he made to the nation just about skyjacking.
Wow.
And apparently this was a fairly regular, you know, like people are just trying to watch TV and there's the president, like, once again
talking about planes.
Yep. Please stop bringing bombs on planes. We vowed it, blah blah blah.
Right.
Yeah, it was a very different time. Very different time indeed. But yes, this book overall was outstanding. I tore through it in a day.
Same. Yeah, it was just a great read.
Yeah, there were a couple of little bumps, but they don't slow you down at all. They just are bumps. So yes, The Skies Belong to Us by Brendan Koerner. And as always, I would love to hear from you guys if you've read it. I'm on Goodreads at Sarah D. Bunting, and you know the social media handles. That's Blotter Presents on both Facebook and Twitter. All right, moving along to our second cold case. This is from The New Yorker from the year 2000, and it is titled, helpfully, A Cold Case. Thanks.
Perfect for this.
Yeah, this is by Philip Gorevich. This, I believe, was turned into a book that contemporary reviews did not seem to think was successful. And I've seen this happen with Vanity Fair articles a million times, that it's like, just be the article. You're novella length already. You're fine.
Even the article felt a little longer than it should have been.
Yeah, a little bit. Here's the case file for every single listener who will not be familiar with this case unless they're blood relatives of the subjects. On February 18th, 1970, which not for nothing is the day after Jeffrey McDonald murdered his entire family in Fort Bragg,
Yes.
A career low life named Frankie Keeler was advised by two West Side restaurateurs, Pete McGinn and Richie Glennon, that he shouldn't be having an affair with a woman whose husband was in the joint. A scrap ensued, but Keeler asked to sit down and talk about it like grown-ups, then shot both men. Everyone knew Keeler did it. No one could seem to close the case. So before he retired, DA head investigator Andy Rosenzweig decided to find out what the hell happened to Keeler and to the investigation. In 2000, the New Yorker's Philip Gorovich got the story, and readers get a story of not one, but two New Yorks that no longer really exist. This article did not seem to quite know how to end,
right.
I will say, but I thought it was really good at capturing that the New York of the late 60s and early 70s that my parents specifically moved out of when my mom got pregnant with me. And also this particular kind of just straight hooligan in Keeler that really seems like a figure out of the past. I thought it was very evocative in that way.
Yeah, I thought it was really well written. I thought the pacing was, I thought it just ran a little long. And like you said, it took a while to finally land for the, you know, the wheels to hit the pavement. But the tension didn't ratchet up as high as I thought it should, considering how long it was. You know, the crime happened, that was intense. Then he goes underground for a while, and then you have that false start, and then they get him. And that's kind of it.
Yeah.
Not to minimize how much work, you know, he had to go through to find him or the journey, but there weren't, you know, I don't know. I shouldn't impose these fictional desires on truth, but it just didn't seem as compelling as some stories that long should be.
Well, they have a quote in here from Steve Sirocco, who was a veteran ADA at the time, who with his partner Dan Bibb worked exclusively on cold murder cases. Sirocco was brought into the cone of silence on the Keeler story and told Gurevich, quote, "The majority of cases we look at are not what I believe Thomas Pynchon called glamour grudges. They have no profile. In fact," he said, quote, "there's a lot of failure." So that sort of speaks to your issues with it. But on the other hand, you sort of expect the New Yorker to like tone up the real life pace just a bit.
Yeah, it just I think it would probably work better if instead of going longer, they had just tightened it up a little bit. So you almost experience the win at the right place in terms of like the arc of the story.
Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah, I mean, but you write fiction, so you're like your ear for the like, well, here's where they should have put it is going to be better than mine. And
I was reading and I was like, this is the climax, but as I see on my sidebar, there's still like half a screen to go.
That I was like, who is this actually John McPhee? Why is this still happening?
Yeah, I guess I was waiting for like the next twist, and there isn't a next twist in real life.
Yeah. And it's especially like given the opening, the extremely strong opening, and he has these kind of not Hemingway-esque, but it had this like, did you ever watch The Naked City?
Yeah.
It had that sort of rhythm to it. Like you could sort of see this happening in black and white, and like Peter Fonda is the guest star.
Yeah, it was really visceral, just kind of, I agree.
And sort of dry. Here's a quote from the early in the piece where Gurevich is describing Keeler's early criminal career. And by early, I mean that he was 15 years old. He had walked off his post at Fort Dix, New Jersey, after suffering unsustainable financial reversals in a crap game. And when it was discovered that he was 15 years old and had lied about his age in order to enlist, he was sent to children's court, declared a juvenile delinquent, and returned to military control. I just love unsustainable financial reversals. Like, just a...
he lost big.
Tiny breath of bitchy vermouth across the martini surface of this piece. I also liked that quote that I read up top at the top of the episode, was Rosenzweig talking to Keeler after he was finally arrested. And Gurevich does a good job both, like, Keeler's a scumbag, but he does have a certain ear for his own, like, an ear for his own story.
Mm-hmm.
And kind of can soundbite himself, apparently, without knowing that he's doing that. And there's also a section where he just sort of lets Rosenzweig think out loud about why Keeler wasn't caught initially and why the investigation was allowed to lapse. And I thought it was smart the way he sort of let the textual tape run in that way. That it's just Rosenzweig musing, like, everybody knows it's him. Where did he go? Why wasn't this followed up? And it's like a full paragraph of that. And I've always been a fan of leaving ums and ahs in a transcript and sort of getting a sense of how people talk, because it lets you know, it gives you a better sense of what they're not saying between.
That's my favorite parts of the story. Sorry to interrupt.
Oh, no, go ahead.
Yeah, just when you're following along with the investigation, and whether it's in fits and starts, you know, this guy, I love the part when he realizes, okay, the only reason we think this guy is dead is because his mom says he's dead, or is probably dead.
Yeah.
And that seems so like the kind of thing that just gets lost in the shuffling, but you have this one diligent guy, like, on the verge of retirement, like, about to lose his third wife because he's so focused on his work. I like the ride-along aspect of the story.
Yes. Totally.
Not so much the, like I said, the arc of it. And though the ending was pretty chilling, not the ending, it felt like it should have been the ending when they do catch him and he says, this is what I was going to do. That was terrifying.
Yeah.
Like, but then it seems then the story just continues after that.
Yeah. I did like, it seemed like the part where he's sort of in the interrogation and unburdening himself, that goes on a bit longer than it should, but Gurevich sort of, without exactly saying that he's doing this, encapsulates what makes a guy like Keeler so scary. When Keeler is saying, all right, well, I'll just read a section of it. His antipathy toward Glennon remains so overwhelming that all he could say is, quote, he was a scumbag. He was a piece of shit. I didn't like this guy. He was an annoyance. I'm trying to explain it as best I can. Like, when people say he'd as soon kill you as look at you, this is the guy they're talking about. Like, he just didn't like Glennon, and he had probably been looking for an excuse to shoot him.
Right.
And, like, he didn't just shoot him. He shot the shit out of him. Like, he emptied a clip each into McGinn and Glennon. So,
yeah, it was not just a headshot and he walked out.
Yeah, Glennon, when it was in his bathrobe, like, don't be a dick.
Yeah.
Let him put some pants on.
Let him get dressed before you kill
him.
Well,
really. If it's all the same to you, which apparently it isn't. I thought that was pretty evocative as to, like, here is the guy's just bad, and he's trying to explain why he killed this guy, and there is no why that people like you and I and Gurevich will understand. And
yeah, he just pissed off.
And even Keeler seems to understand that that's true. So
yeah, that was interesting. That was, you know, he just struck a weird nerve that none of us can really relate to because we're not psychopaths.
Yeah. Yes. Blink. Just kidding.
Yeah.
I really liked this story. I can't imagine that the book worked, though. I mean, again, listeners, if you have read either, we'll link to the article in the show notes. But if you read the book, like, this is definitely one where it already sort of felt like it was having trouble winding up. So I don't think that making it longer was necessarily the answer.
Keep winding.
But this is one of those stories where the subject is doing a lot of the work, because on the one hand, we're captivated by criminals who get away or get away with it. Like, even as we're like angry about that, scared about that, there is something about like the successful heist, or, you know, the successful, like, just walking into another life, like we were just talking about with Kathy Kirkow. That's like, I mean, it's not like we admire it, but at the same time, we kind of do. Like, it's fascinating to us, for good or ill.
Yeah, the idea that you could do this kind of terrible thing, but then sneak away and create a new life, for better or worse, is enticing to people.
Yeah, especially when, like, everybody knows that you did it, and there were witnesses, and you were, like, a known bad actor, and you just were like, well, maybe in California. And he's, you know,
just drop a smoke bomb and walk away.
Yeah. And I don't think he even did drop a smoke bomb. He like walked over to the Coliseum and worked there for a few years and then was like, it's too cold here, and like moved away.
I'm going west.
But then,
though, it's funny because while I was reading it, I did wonder if there was a book, because I was thinking to myself, wow, it's dragging a little bit, but it's so interesting that if it's reframed a little bit, it could be a good book. Just the idea of this retired guy, like this guy heading into retirement, like his last case. I mean, I think the pieces are there. He would have to shuffle it around and really add more to the characters to make it work as a book, though.
Ooh, all right. Here's what. We get Brendan Koerner to take this story, pull it apart, put it in a framework of like 10 or 15 years worth of dudes like this who are like, I should probably leave the state, and then did, and then intersperse it with, you know, Andy Rosenzweig's futile efforts to retire to Newport to his bookshop called Bookum,
which I love. Yeah, that's amazing.
Which, P.S., that will also be in the show notes because it still exists, and I don't know if he's still living, but the business owner is listed as Mary Rosenzweig, so. But it's still there.
Oh, good. I'm glad we're still there. That's great.
But I mean, I was going to open an all true crime bookstore one day called Bookum, and now I can't. Well, maybe
you still can.
Maybe I can, as long as I don't do it in Rhode Island, right?
Yeah, on the same street. I mean, you could probably still do it in Rhode Island.
Or I could just ask to be franchised.
Yeah, Bookum again.
Yeah. My husband, as I mentioned, is named Dan. So I could call this one Bookum Dano.
Yeah, there you go.
It's probably copyright. I do think that this story has like book potential because we're captivated by guys who get away, but we also want bad guys caught and like relatable good guys to do the catching. And this story has both. So it was going to be hard for Gourevitch to screw it up. And I don't think he did. I think he just kind of didn't know. Maybe his editor was like, you know, and for your grand zoom out conclusion. And he was like, I don't know.
Yeah. You're missing 10,000 words. And okay.
Yeah. Cops never retire. What do you.
The one thing I did think it was missing, and this is just, again, trying to impose fiction on nonfiction, is the people left behind by these, you know, who was mourning for these two guys that were killed? Because it seemed like one bad dude killed two like kind of not great dudes, like not bad per se, but not necessarily good stand-up citizens, you know. So I wanted to know more about who they left behind, and that probably would have added a little more gravitas to the whole thing.
Well, there was some good, there was a good sort of Naked City, you know, jazzy, mid-century jazzy paragraph about Glennon and his, that he was a boxer, and he mostly was a boxer because he liked to say that he was a boxer, and he was what they called a ham and egger. And I was like,
that was a great term.
Like, I knew what that meant, but then I had to look up what, like, where does that come from? And it came from, like, you know, certain like Depression era fighters, I think, were promised like they'd have to throw the fight, but they'd get a ham and egg dinner, which like people were eating boiled shoes and grass in 1932. Right. So that's where that came from. And then I vanished on a wiki hole of related boxing terms, you know, like tomato can and stuff like that. And then I ordered a mid-century slang dictionary on Amazon because I have a problem.
Yeah, why not?
With buying and like reading dictionaries, actually.
The Urban Dictionary of 50 years ago.
Yeah, it literally is that. I'm so excited for it to arrive.
Wow.
This podcast is not sponsored by Amazon. In fact, it's quite the reverse. But yeah, I liked this article. I liked all of the little side alleys of other like Googling, researching things that I went down. And it made me want to reread Killings by Calvin Trillin, because this is like, he has that tone down, but
yeah,
but is a little better able to wrap it up at like, and see where his end is, I think.
Yeah, I thought it was really good. I mean, it definitely, I read all the way through and I did start wondering how it would work as a book. So to me, that's a good sign, a sign of a good article. It did, aside from just running a little long at the end and the whole idea of not really knowing who the murdered left behind, you know, considering what, I thought it was good. I thought I enjoyed it.
Yeah. And there's also side-by-side photo, which will be on social media this week, of the FBI's, or maybe it was NYPD's, aging software, which made what they thought Keeler would look like. He just looked very like, who's the guy who played played Hannibal on the A-Team? Peppard? George Peppard.
Oh yeah.
Just like very like cheekbonesy silver fox, and then that's next to his actual intake mugshot from when they caught him.
He's like super jowly.
And he's just this like, there are literally 400 guys within the sound of my voice who look like that in Bay Ridge.
Yeah, the before, or the kind of synthesized photo looked like that episode of Star Trek, the original series, where they all get really old, but they just look like themselves with like talcum powder in their
hair. Yes. Absolutely.
Yeah.
And then he looks like, you know, he's got a couple of teeth out and hasn't trimmed the old ear hair and just looks like, you know, your average.
Showering isn't like a daily routine.
No, stretched out neck t-shirt. And you're like, yeah, so this is like, in one photo, there's this sort of romanticized escaped criminal living on the lam and the reality. Which was this.
Yeah, it's like that meme that's going on Facebook where everyone's posting like their 2009 profile photo and then their 2019 profile photo. And
yeah.
Like these two things do not belong together.
No, they don't. As someone posted on Twitter today, I think it was Maris Kreitzman, she's like, I'm really glad that chunkier eyeglasses frames have come in style. And I was like, that's exactly what I would say about my 2009 profile photo.
Yeah.
What am I, Sally Jesse?
It all worked out.
It did, I think, for everyone.
Yeah.
Not for Keeler, though. Sorry, buddy. He must have passed away by now. I couldn't find a little cursory Googling. I couldn't.
He must have. Yeah, I'm not.
Couldn't turn up his fate. But listeners, you're welcome to unearth any information on that and let us know. And once again, that is Philip Gourevitch's A Cold Case from, I believe, February of 2000 in The New Yorker. All right, before I get into the upcoming booking sheet, Alex, plug your shit. Where else can listeners find you and your works and days?
You can find me on alexsegura.com. You can find all the novels I've written. I write the Pete Fernandez Miami Mystery Series, which is a PI series set in Miami. And you can follow me on Twitter at alex_segura, S-E-G-U-R-A. I also work at Archie Comics. That's my day job. So I have very little to complain about.
And I think you and I are going to be reunited on an upcoming deep dive. Is that right? Are we talking Fatal Vision together?
Yeah, we're talking some Fatal Vision, which I need to reread.
I will reread it, but sadly, I don't even really need to. It's really sad.
It's programmed into your brain.
It really is. All the additions and the follow-up. But that's a matter for another time.
It's funny,
time.
They, you know, you mentioned the Jeffrey McDonald case, and that was a huge influence on one of my books. Not to plug my own book to you directly on your own show.
Oh, no, please.
Yeah. I'll send you a link to it when we're offline.
Excellent. That might sneak into the show notes as well.
Yeah.
Thank you so much for coming on the show. I really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me. This was fun.
All right, folks, coming up, Piper Weiss on Ted Bundy, Toby Ball on Murder Mountain, Mark Blankenship on A Very British Scandal, and Kevin Smokler on The Onion Field. Until then, if you've got a tip for The Blotter Presents, you can find me on social media, Blotter Presents on Facebook and Twitter. You can email me at bunting@the-blotter.com. And you can become an official Blotter Tipster at patreon.com/blotterpresents. If you like the podcast, please tell a friend and give it a 5-star review on iTunes. If you don't like the podcast, keep it to yourself. My guest has been Alex Segura. He's on Twitter at @Alex_Segura. I'm Sarah D. Bunting, and I confidentially inform you that I hope you'll tune in next time.